You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, SixthSense. SixthSense provides award-winning cloud-based automated endpoint and vulnerability management solutions to streamline IT and security operations. With its advanced platform, businesses gain complete visibility and control over their infrastructure, reducing IT and security risks and optimizing operational efficiency. With SixthSense, you'll get real-time alerts, risk-based vulnerability prioritization and remediations, and an intuitive automation and orchestration engine so you can focus on your core business goals, confident in the knowledge that your enterprise is secure, compliant, and running smoothly. To learn why enterprises choose SixthSense, visit SixthSense.com.
Hello, and welcome to SpyCast from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Peter Ernest, the executive director of the museum. I served for some 36 years in the Central Intelligence Agency, largely as what is called an operations officer or a case officer. Every month, we'll be bringing you interesting talks with visitors, with authors, with others who have something to do with the world of intelligence and espionage. My guest today is Keith Jeffrey, who is a professor of history at Queen's College Belfast. Obtained his PhD from Cambridge and has taught at universities in Northern Ireland and Australia. He has written extensively on British and Irish military and intelligence history, and he was commissioned to do an authorized history of MI6, which is, of course, the British equivalent, the closest there is really to CIA, our Central Intelligence Agency. And it has just been published, and he's graciously agreed to be with us. Keith Jeffrey, welcome.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
You're in the States now for a tour, I take
That's
it?
Right.
For
10 days in New York and Washington. I'm not allowed to go anywhere else, possibly for security reasons, or perhaps the publisher can't afford to send me
there. Well, security reasons certainly sounds more glamorous than the publisher's means. I'd like to take this from the point of view. This is an extraordinary book. The fact that MI6, and we'll just refer to it as MI6,
yes.
Also the Secret Intelligence Service,
yes.
Right, SIS, those are synonymous.
Yeah.
And the term SIS, which was used first and why?
Well, Secret Intelligence Service is the correct title. It's the legal title, and it came into use in the early 1920s. It was founded in 1909 as the Secret Service Bureau. There was a Home Department to look after domestic affairs, which broadly analogous to the FBI, and a foreign department to look after foreign intelligence, more or less equivalent to the CIA. In the early days, it had various different titles, but there is a continuity of the institution, which emerged in 1919 or 1920 or so as the Secret Intelligence Service. MI6 was adopted at the beginning of the Second World War simply as a cover name. It's a kind of post office box. It is literally meaningless, although you might read it as Military Intelligence 6. There are other military intelligence branches and have been, but MI6 is simply an accommodation address adopted. And it's become the most popular kind of brand name. If you want brand recognition, MI6 will do.
Is the one, I agree with you, that's the one that you typically hear first, although often
yes.
In talking to intelligence people, they'll use SIS
yes.
or Secret Intelligence Service. I think what's so quite extraordinary about this for us is that it has been in existence since 1909 and now is authorizing an official, let's say an unauthorized
mm-hmm.
history,
yes.
Which you've now done, through 1949.
Yep.
There is no equivalent in CIA.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very fine history done by a fellow named John Ranlaw, which
mm-hmm.
I think
yes,
went
yeah.
up into the 80s, 85, mm-hmm. something. But there is no such thing as an authorized history. What did that mean in terms of your work? In other words, what sort of access did you have to archives? Right. What sort of limitations were put on you? Can you just give a sense of what it was like
Well, absolutely. I mean, there's an inevitable tension between the most secretive organization in the British government, which has very deep secrets. It does very secret stuff. If it doesn't, it's not doing its job correctly. And the commissioning of a history which is going to be published, and a history which is written by an independent academic historian. And in a way, people are always asking me, what is the big secret in this book? What's the big secret, you know? And they're expecting to hear about some super spy or something. The big secret is the book itself. It is almost counterintuitive that this organization would commission a history like this. So that's the question that needs to be addressed. And it has to do with a centenary. Any organization, any powerful, successful, important organization, such as this is, which reaches a significant anniversary, wants its history written. And that's a very powerful motivation. When you find that its sister service, MI5, the security service, have commissioned a centenary history themselves, there's another little prod to push them. You know, you don't like to see them publishing a history while you don't. And I think the nature of how people regard this institution, of course, has changed in Britain over the years. It didn't officially exist until 1994, and any British official British spokesman, if you ask them, what about MI6, they would say, I can neither confirm nor deny the existence of any such organisation. Now, everybody knew this. In wartime it was admitted that there was secret intelligence, but in peacetime not. And the dogs in the street knew about it. But what you got was increasing mythologization of the service, that the ideas that people had about it, while not unimportant for the service's kind of reputation as a kind of false force multiplier, if you like, the mythology grew up to such an extent that also it was thought appropriate by the time you get to the centenary to set the record straight. And the only way you can set the record straight is by using the archives themselves of the organisation. Now, the archive of MI6 is the holy grail of British archives. It's the only government department in Britain that doesn't release its archives in any way. It doesn't hand them over to the National Archives. Everybody else does it. The other intelligence agencies do it, MI6, or MI5 rather, GCHQ, the Signals Intelligence Agency, a special branch, you know, they all hand their documents over. But MI6 doesn't, and have no intention, so far as I am aware, ever to do so. So there's immediately a problem. It's not a case of just getting someone to go and look at these things. And they took, I think, the rather brave decision, and possibly risky decision, to commission me. And there was a selection process. I wasn't the only person in the frame, but I got the prize, if you like, of this, to look at the first 40 years of the service. So that's really the background to the venture.
Well, were you in fact, there were two questions really. 40 years is a long time. Mm. So the question that would come to me, I know you've done at least 13 or 14 books you've either written or edited. How do you bite that off? How do you approach an archive of that size, particularly you're one person? Were you given free run?
Yeah.
And how do you go about it?
Well, that's a very important question about free run. Yes. Part of the deal was that I would have absolutely unrestricted access to the archives that have remained. And that was a deal breaker. If I had discovered that I wasn't being shown stuff, that would have been a resigning matter, and no question about that. Now, in order for that to happen, I had to have security clearance at indeed the highest level. Agency have never, do not make any distinction between contemporary secrets and historic secrets. They've never had to, because they never dealt in history. So I am cleared up to the eyeballs to see what they might show the Prime Minister on a Monday morning if they want. I mean, they don't show it to me, and I don't actually want to see it. I have enough to do. Thank you very much. So I am completely cleared and completely vetted. Now, that has advantages and disadvantages. I mean, it's the only way I can get to see the archive. It does mean that I am an insider in some way, although I'm an independent scholar. I'm a trustee, a trusted person. And in the eyes of some of my more sceptical colleagues, perhaps rightly, they might think me, because I am cleared and trusted to do it, I am perhaps the least suitable person to write an independent critical history, with proper critical appraisal. Now, there's nothing I can do about that except, say, read the book and make up your own mind. In order to get access to this archive, this holy grail of British archives, I had to be cleared. And I wasn't alone, there was a team. I had a full-time research assistant, I had a number of other assistants from within the service, some retired members of the service who are interested in the history, very valuable kind of assistance, because they could tell me stuff about the service that I could not find from books and documents. They could say, this feels right or this doesn't feel right. And they could introduce me, of course, to the history of the history that the service themselves perceived of their past, which is not always the same. It didn't always match the history I discovered, in fact. But that's a starting point. Another starting point is, in effect, this study of this organisation does not change the history of the first half of the 20th century. The United Kingdom was on the winning side in both world wars. There's not some extraordinary sort of astonishing revelation. Hermann Göring was not, a British spy and reporting forwards or back. It's not like that. What you do get, or what I think I've been able to do, or at least I've attempted to do, is to fill in some very, very large gaps of the intelligence history for this period, to provide an enormous piece of the jigsaw, which is of that intelligence history. And it's a central piece. It's a central piece without which a lot of other stories cannot be told. And it also tells, and that's all I can do, is to tell the story from, as it were, within headquarters, within MI6 headquarters, an office block called Broadway for most of my period, from the 1920s through indeed until the 1960s. But it's the view from Broadway told from the documents that exist there. And I can't and I won't go beyond the historical evidence I've got. So in some ways, this history fills in gaps, but where there are still points at which we simply don't know and we can't say. And that's the reality, both of intelligence work sometimes and of history quite frequently.
Yes. I'm going to ask you sort of an astonishment question. Was it exciting? How did you feel when you were walking down the London street knowing your head was now stuffed with all these secrets that no one else knew on the street and you could not confide? Yes. Of course, you had to wait until you had done your book and had it vetted.
Yes.
But did you find, as you began to absorb this material and work with it and interview some of the veterans, that you truly sort of changed your perspective on things?
Well, it's an enormous thrill to, as it were, venture into a virgin archive. This is virgin territory. Nobody else, in the service, sure, they played around and they messed around with the archive, because they use it for operational purposes and things. They weren't keeping it, indeed, for historical purposes. But it was a fantastic thrill, to step into, a secure building and to read materials that were as secret as any materials might be in the United Kingdom. And even the process of doing it, when I was writing my history, because writing the history in a sort of strange sort of way is the easy bit. That's what I do. I'm a professional historian. I've spent 30 years doing that. And so writing history is what my expertise, that's the expertise I bring to this. Negotiating the text out of the building now is a different exercise, which was invigorating, frustrating, alarming, angering, exciting, all at the same time, and amusing sometimes. And while I was writing this, drafts of this history, my drafts themselves were classified documents. So I couldn't take anything home. Everything had to be locked away in a secure cupboard, as it were, every night. They have a clean desk policy. It's a nightmare. It is an utter nightmare, because I don't appeal. I take the W.C. Fields line that an empty desk is an empty mind, and I like my materials about me, and I had a very untidy cupboard, of course, as a result, locked up every night. But having to do that meant and you can't take your work home. I mean, you can take stuff in your head, sure, and so in that way I had a little kind of illumination as to what it might be to be an intelligence agent out there, not in my case in hostile territory, but certainly in foreign territory.
This is an impressive looking tome, The Secret History of MI6, just come out now in hardback by the Penguin Press. Let me just ask you something. I'm asking this on behalf of people in intelligence as well as so many that aren't. MI6, as you say, is a brand name. People know about MI6, British intelligence. Is this an eye-opener? Will people read this and realize things about the nature of British intelligence, particularly foreign intelligence, that's which was primarily affected abroad, and just find some extraordinary insight into incidents and developments that took place, certainly through 49, which gets us into the eve of the Cold War?
Well, people will, of course, receive what's in the book and appreciate what's in the book at different levels, depending on what they know already. For someone who knows nothing about the actual mechanics of spying, except what they might read in the paper or in a novel or in some popular thing, this will give them the real McCoy. I mean, how it actually was and how it's actually done. For those who know quite a lot about intelligence, in fact, and know a lot about British intelligence, and who, for example, are well aware of the tremendous triumphs of Bletchley Park and the Signals Intelligence Agency during the Second World War, utterly important, and the most important, in fact, intelligence achievement of the Second World War. But what this will do is it restores the context of that achievement in two ways. Firstly, Bletchley Park is under the management of MI6. From the early 1920s, Bletchley Park and the Signals Intelligence, British Signals Intelligence capability is run from MI6. So immediately there's a relationship there, which is not as explicit as it might be in the existing histories from the Bletchley Park end, and I think it's important to establish that. Now, there is a debate to run as to whether the achievements of Bletchley Park were because of or despite that management, and it's not all on one side of the ledger. But again, I've tried to write that relationship in a kind of even-handed way. But what's also the case is that the human intelligence dimension of Britain's intelligence history over the first half of the century have really not had their full due. When Sir Harry Hinsley was writing, and his team were writing their great official histories, MI6 SAS refused to be involved in that. He was given some assistance with it at a kind of one first remove, but he wasn't given any access to the documents or the archives of MI6 in any way. So in a way, MI6 prevented their story from fully being told, and that was another sort of idea behind commissioning the history, was to restore that balance. Now, if you look at the Signals Intelligence story, it begins, or one of the most important triggers to set off the successes of Bletchley Park is a human intelligence source, and it's a French human intelligence source. They have a spy at the centre of the German communications in the early 1930s who informs them quite a lot about the Enigma developments. The French share this information with the Poles, who make terrific technical developments in the late 1930s. And because MI6 has an increasingly good and satisfactory liaison, a human intelligence relationship through a man called Dunderdale, Wilfred Biffy Dunderdale, whom I can talk about again because he's an interesting character. But Dunderdale is the head of station in Paris, and he builds up, and with the rest of the service, such a level of trust with the French that the French begin to share this information with the British. And without that kind of human intelligence sort of network and connection, you don't have the beginnings of the successful cracking of the Enigma code. Now, there's a lot of technical business goes on. There's the computers they build and all the rest of it. But there's a human intelligence dimension. There are other ways in which MI6 contributes to Britain's Second World War successes in a technical basis. Now, you know, we're all... We see all these gadgets and technical things and sort of signals intelligence and intercepting you know, cell phones and what have you. And what MI6 do in the from the 30s onwards is they provide some of the essential technical underpinning for intelligence generally and for signals intelligence in particular. They supply some of the raw material. They also supply secure channels for disseminating the intelligence. Now, intelligence... itself gathered is of no use as an abstract. It has to be delivered to where it's needed. And Bletchley Park did not provide the secure channels to where it was needed. MI6 provided those. So without that, it was, you know, vitiates the whole exercise.
One comment and then I think a major question. You referred to Sir Harry Hinsley. That was the first government-authorized history of British intelligence.
It was.
Without getting into the detail,
yeah.
But that's
yeah.
the gentleman
yes.
you met.
Yes.
There is a lot made of the sense that the Americans informing the CIA in 1947, they, of course, mm-hmm. had OSS and mm-hmm. British had SOE, but when CIA came into being, there was a very strong sense that the mentors of, mm-hmm. of Dulles and of CIA as it came in to be were the British, was British mm-hmm. intelligence. Could you just comment on it based on your
yes.
own research?
Well, here's another importance for the human dimension and particularly liaison. I mean, I think one of the stories that has come out very strongly, one of the themes that has come out very strongly is the importance of liaison with other intelligence services. They're not always allied intelligence services. They're not always very friendly. They may not be. You may find common cause. For example, in the 1930s, the British and the Nazis had common cause against the communists. And there are some overlap there, liaison relationships there. Now, there are other areas where the British and the Nazis have no common cause whatsoever. So it's not absolutely straightforward. Sometimes you have to dine with unsavory characters, and you maybe use a longish spoon for this, but you still dine with them. And but in terms of the Anglo-American relationship, there's a key development in the Second World War. The head of station, the MI6 head in North America, is in fact a Canadian, a man called Bill Stevenson, Sir William Stevenson, or later Sir William Stevenson, who runs a very extensive operation called the British Security Coordination out of the Rockefeller Building in Manhattan. And Stevenson represents, again, one of those essential human personal linkages. He's a pal of Wild Bill Donovan, First World War hero, Irish-American. He's not necessarily pro-Brit in a pro-Brit way, but he is, I think, convinced of the necessity for the United States to line up with the democracies against the totalitarian fascist challenge. He's also a pal, of course, of Roosevelt. So you get these personal links. And Stevenson goes to Donovan and says, you know, you Americans ought to be doing more of the sorts of things we are already doing. Is that the covert operations, intelligence, and indeed special operations are an essential part of modern world and modern warfare. Donovan is persuaded of this, Roosevelt is persuaded of this, and Donovan comes out as the first head of the OSS, very important, and of course a precursor of CIA. And when he comes to Britain, he makes sure that MI6, Sir Stuart Mingies, who's the chief, makes sure that the red carpet is rolled out for old Donovan, and he has given access to all sorts of people, which helps underpin and consolidate the that closest of all alliances which emerged in the Second World War, that between Britain and America.
You know, I have to, the book that you've now authored is a tremendous contribution to intelligence literature. So I think it will stand as such, and I think you're going to be asked to talk about it for some years to come and the work that you did. So I thank you for that. I have to raise, though, of course, one of the best-known members of MI6 and get your comments on that, the man known as James Bond, who had a license to kill.
Yeah.
I can't help it. I have to apologize, but I feel we can't talk about MI6 without at least so much of, as you know, of popular feeling, a sense of intelligence agencies is drawn from popular culture, television, movies, book. And there's no greater figure striding through the intelligence pop culture than James Bond.
No, of course. He is the most famous single spy in the world, and he works for MI6, which becomes the most famous single spying organization in the world. Now, that's brand recognition of a very high order. And if people buy this book and read this book, that's what I want them to do, is to read this book, because they think they'll find the real James Bond in it, that's all right with me, because they will. This is better than James Bond. This is better than James Bond because it's not a cartoon character. It's not with one bound he's free. James Bond survives to the end of every single one of those movies and those novels. Now, he's battered and bruised, but he survives. This is not how it works in the real world, I regret to say. The real world is much grainier, is much more difficult, and sometimes much more lethal. Not, of course, in respect of the license to kill. There are more fatalities. Look, in the first 3 minutes of a James Bond movie, directed by the service, than in the entire history of MI6, at least for the first 40 years. I looked hard for killings. But precisely because of that. And there are two or three killings which I have looked at in some detail as a result. But really, there are about two that you could reasonably call directed killings. And one of them is arguably an accidental one. There's a very interesting debate about systematic assassination during the Second World War, which again, as someone says, I'm not against killing Germans. You can kill as many as you like. I have a long list, but it's not that easy. If it were that easy, in this sort of targeted, systematic way, people would be doing it all the time. And this is in a context, of course, where bombs are dropping and killing thousands of people at one time. So it's not an issue about not killing Germans. It's about whether it's effective and it actually works. And the kind of James Bond slam dam, thank you, ma'am, kind of thing, it just doesn't match the reality. Now, Ian Fleming, the author of the James Bond novels, did have intelligence experience. He was the personal assistant of the director of naval intelligence, a man called Godfrey, knew a lot about what was going on in the secret world. He was also a pal of the head of station, the MI6 head of station in Paris, Wilfred Biffy Dunderdale. And Biffy Dunderdale was a dashing figure. He was first hired in 1919. He was brought up in Russia of a British expatriate family who were working in a shipyard in Odessa. He had fluent Russian. And here's the first difference between your James Bond on the movies and the real James Bond. James Bond doesn't seem to speak a whole lot of foreign languages, as I recall. You just don't get on in the service unless, frankly, you have a facility for foreign languages. That's a sine qua non, you know, without which you don't do it. So immediately the reality is actually better and cleverer and more able than the film. But Dunderdale had a penchant for fast cars and for pretty women. He was a man of great savoir faire, great style. We have a picture of him in the book with his false passport that he used in the autumn of 1940 to go to Lisbon to meet representatives of the French intelligence services out of Vichy. Now again, here's this human intelligence liaison building up. These relationships, and this is very important and it's not well understood, the relationship with the French intelligence agency, which he had built up in the 1930s, continued after the Germans defeat the French and occupy most of the country. And he meets these people using a passport under the name of John Green. John Green is closer to James Bond than Biffy Dunderdale, so maybe there's a wee hint there, I don't know. The relationships he'd built up with the French are enormously productive, not just what they'd given him with Enigma, but after the Germans have defeated France. They're still sending material out, and they never tell the secret, the French never give up the secret, that they had told the Brits about Enigma. Now, that's very important, too. So Biffy Dunderdale is a kind of real James Bond. And in his old age, he used to tell stories. He said he used to see stories that he'd recognised stories in the James Bond novels that he'd told Ian Fleming. But he was distressingly vague about the precise ones. Nevertheless, okay, you want the stuff. There's a man called Peter Tazelaar, who's a Dutch agent, and they want to put him ashore in Holland in 1941 on the beach at Scheveningen, where there's a casino on the beach. And in those good old days, you wore a tuxedo to the casino. I understand that standards have slipped laterally, but the Dutch were respectable people, and they dressed up nicely to go and lose their money in the casino. And what they do with old Tazelaar is they kit him out with a tuxedo, and they put him in a wetsuit, and they sprinkle him with a bit of brandy so he'll seem as if he's a bit the worse for wear, and they put him on the boat on the straight onto the beach so he can jump out of the wetsuit and then stroll in among the people. Now, does that have a wee echo to some James Bond kind of story? Well, it's real, and it happened.
That's a wonderful story, and neither Dunderdale nor any of the other fellows had, quote, a license to kill. I think you've pretty well dispelled that. What was never apparent to me in the Bond movies that he was operating with a government expense account. I think we can agree on that.
No.
It's been wonderful having you here, and you evince such great enthusiasm in talking about this. I've got to believe that comes out in the book, too, so I very much look forward to reading it. Again, welcome to America, welcome to the Spy Museum, and thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Well, we look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. That's spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you.